Surf now.
Hey, what's up, masterminds? It's Zach Applewhite. I'm here with three fantastic guests from Tabletop Journeys. These guys have done a Kickstarter before. They're doing one now. I wanted to take a moment, meet with these guys, and pick their brains about what it was like transferring from a more micro Kickstarter to something bigger, what's different, what they learned. Guys, welcome.
Hey, Zach, thanks for having us
Thank
on
you.
here.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to talk with you with all the folks that are tuning in to kind of figure this whole game out. And if we can help in that process, we'd love to. So
Awesome. I love
absolutely.
let's start off with a round of introductions. Who are you? And like what got you into whatever who are you? What do you do and why?
Ah, sure. Excellent.
Let me start with the dime tour, and I'll go ahead and launch off here, and then I'm sure that Luinica and Glenn will jump on from there. But we are Josh, Glenn, and Luinica. We are the Tabletop Journeys podcast. We've been on the air on the interwebs anyway for gosh, almost 4 years
Almost
now.
on our way towards
No.
four.
Yeah, we're
Wow.
getting
Okay,
there.
that's
Yeah.
weird. Yeah, so almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years in November. Yeah. Okay. Wow. Gosh, probably about 3 years into that process, we also started doing our own content creation. We are a show that focuses on home brewing and world building and inspiration from other sources of media and stuff like that. Like we pull sources from a variety of different or inspiration from a variety of different sources. And 3 years ago or so, we started putting together our own content to go ahead and sell up on DM's Guild. And then we just kind of started progressing from there. And we are now in the middle of Kickstarter number two for our fourth book. Yeah. And by book, I mean we put out like a bunch of like small pamphlets type stuff. Like that stuff, we didn't count that in the count. We mean like full size books, like 60 plus 60 to 180 pages. So yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm Lee Wanika. I'm one of the th three of us.
Thank you.
So I guess we came to this quite honestly. We used to have a lot of discussions. All three of us have been gaming for a while. Our tagline, which grows more and more every year, is something like between the three of us, we have well over 100 years of gaming experience. So we've been at this for more than a hot minute.
The old folk.
Yeah. A vintage disposition, I prefer to say. But somewhere along the lines, we found ourselves constantly talking about the game, talking about the craft of the game, how to improve the game, because we have participated in lots of games where everybody had the best intentions, but they struggled in areas. And so we would go to parties or shindigs, soirees, or just break out of any event that we happen to be at and invariably start talking gaming. And one of the things that we used to do is say, we should do a podcast. And lo and behold, pandemic, as so many did, why am I doing this? Why don't I do something I'm passionate about? Thus, the podcast was born. Glenn joined us moments later, like in the grand scheme of things, a blink of an eye. And we've been kind of at it for a while, but one of the very early decisions we made is we want to do content creation. And so we started small, built larger and larger to get to the point where we are. And we've constantly been inviting others in to give us information. We ask questions constantly, and that's kind of one of the hallmarks of a good storyteller is asking your players questions, as well as asking yourself questions. You have to do some self-introspection to get better at anything you do. And that's just something that we've made sure we keep doing. We keep asking questions. We keep investigating. We keep looking at newer and different resources to see, hey, is there something here we can borrow to make this better?
Pretty well said by both of my co-hosts. I'm Glenn, the third co-host of Tabletop Journeys. And yeah, like they said, they started up this podcast and I listened to a couple episodes and I really loved what they were doing. Leewanik and I have been friends since we met in Boy Scouts when I was like 12 and he was 13 or 11 and 12, one of the two, somewhere in there, long, long time ago. And then I met Josh through Leewanik playing the Vampire the Masquerade while
Yeah.
Iwanika was living in Maine and then
Probably
became friends
20
with
years
him.
ago anyway, right? Like that's
Yes. Yes. So not quite as old a friend as Iwanika, but still at least 2 decades, right?
Right.
So I felt pretty comfortable reaching out to them because I call myself a maker. I write, I do some art, I do some graphic art. I just love making things. And content creation was definitely the side that I wanted to join the most, but I do like talking too. So I reached out and said, guys, I want in. And, you know, they were gracious enough to let me in, and we haven't looked back since.
Awesome. I love it. So you were already doing DMs Guild. Let's talk about that for a moment. All right. So how is DMs Guild working for you, and why did Kickstarter come as something that you wanted to at least try out later on?
So I'll let Josh talk about some of the numbers involved, but I can talk about it more from an emotional standpoint. I found DMs Guild to be useful, yet restraining and at the same time.
Yep.
I think the briefest discussion for those in the content community, if they're not already aware, is if you're producing 5e content, you can do so anywhere, anytime, anyhow you want, especially since the unraveling of the OGL crisis earlier this year.
And it moving into Creative Commons.
Right. So you can do 5e content. Beware of people's IP, but other than that, you can do 5e. And we knew that going in. However, there are certain things that are very specific, and some of those things we really wanted to touch on. We love Dragonlance. You can't do that anywhere else.
Right.
So we found, in order to scratch some of those itches that we have, it is the only avenue. And there were some decisions, like, we don't know how to do some of these other things right yet. We didn't want to jump in before we were ready, and we wanted successes before we started getting too big too quickly. So for us, it was start with DMs Guild because it's a focused D&D audience.
A proving ground, if you will, for us to practice in.
So we can, one, see where our craft is and see where we need to go, see what we're doing. Then we would consider moving into other avenues from there. And one of the thoughts was we would then go into drive-through directly as opposed to DMs Guild for our non-content. But when we got ready to make that decision, we said, you know what? I think we're ready to do Kickstarter. We're ready to go a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. We're ready to have a little bit more control of our product and our content, and we're ready to quite honestly to make a little bit more money so we can improve the quality of our books. So the idea is not so much that we're going home writing fat checks, eating happy steaks with giant lobsters. That would be nice.
Wait, we get paid?
That's not what kind of podcast.
That would be wonderful, but that ain't how this game gets played.
If you two are buying steaks, we need to rediscuss our contract.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but dinner like a year ago.
Yeah, like we got one dinner the last time. No, but you know, I'm thinking of those little ones that you get at the dollar store for the Barbie house. And I'm not the big Barbie house, but the little tiny Barbie houses. Yeah. We can afford one and a half of those.
Yeah.
We just had to work the Barbie movie in.
Always be closing, baby. Always be closing. Got to build that audience, right? Bridge those gaps.
Let me just kind of build on kind of what Lee Monique was saying. For me, the shift between putting out kind of smaller things or things that were directed on DMs Guild, trying to tap into that audience, trying to strike gold and get that platinum winner or whatever like that on DMs Guild. The change for me came with a conversation that I was having with Chris from Loresmith Publications, which is, they're no longer publishing now, but he did something kind of similar to what you're doing here, Zach, where it was kind of a creators forum on his Discord server. And he was just pulling content creators together to say, hey, what are you doing and why are you doing and how can we all help each other? And, you know, we talked about, I think this was just after our second book, Traveler's Guide to the Multiverse, came out, which was a DMs Guild exclusive. You know, and we at that point were already talking about our third book. And so I was saying, yeah, you know, we're talking about the third book. It's going to be a bigger book. It's going to have more content, you know, and everything, you know, and we're going to be putting it on DMs Guild, but we're not really sure how to, you know, kind of what the right balance is for DMs Guild. Is DMs Guild better for like smaller things, like incremental changes, or is it better for big things or whatever? And Chris is like, yeah, DMs Guild is not where you want to go. He's like, why aren't you doing something like Kickstarter or Backer, you know, Backer Kit really hadn't started their kind of, sorry, excuse me, their backer stuff yet. But why aren't you doing a Kickstarter or Indiegogo or whatever? And I was like, well, I guess I don't know. I don't know why we're not. He's like, well, you should, because you can always take something and put it on DMs Guild, which is the more restrictive licensing, once it's been on Kickstarter or once it's been on something else, but never start with the platform that is most restrictive, because all that it does is that's a DM's Guild is very much a dead end. And for those of you that are maybe kind of getting in there, that's something that you really need to know, is that once you've put something on DM's Guild, it can't go anywhere else. DM's Guild has an exclusive license on that. It's DriveThruRPG gives you the option where you can choose to be exclusive or not. And if you are not, you pay a lot more royalties. Mm. Like you pay like 70% to them if you're not exclusive, which is insane.
Ludicrous.
Right? Yeah. Ludicrous. Yeah. But DM's Guild, it's a 50-50 split. And it's a dead end. Once it's on DM's Guild, that's where it stops. You can't put it anyplace else.
Ask, like, yeah. Are you guys going to do a release of all of like a vault of your DM's Guild material? Are you using those as add-ons? And like that, I looked at DriveThruRPG. I never even like looked at DM's Guild, and they were looking at 70%. And I'm like, I'm just greedy.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that very much, we all of our stuff is still on, or the stuff that was on DM's Guild is still on DM's Guild, right? So it's, so we try to do some like bundles and stuff and from time to time. But honestly, that it's never really been, nothing on there has ever really been a big winner for us. We have one copper publication. Yeah, we have our first book went copper. It kind of continues to get like one or two sales a month, which is nice. But nothing there has ever really been a big winner. We certainly, even after expenses and everything, made probably double on our first Kickstarter, not even this one, but our first Kickstarter, we made probably double what we had ever made on DM's Guild, all said and done. And I'd have to go back and double check the numbers exactly, but I don't think it's that far off.
I would probably also add that restrictive license is the bigger concern for me. Mm-hmm. We're in the business of creating ideas and content. And at some point, one of the ideas that we have is going to be big. I mean, that's why we do this. I think that's the dream. That's what everybody is in this game for, is it's not just, I'm going to do this thing, make $30 and call it good. They're like, I'm going to do this thing and see if people love it. But one of these ideas might be the idea, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's got that dream. Right. And part of the concern was, if we lock that dream mm-hmm. in a chest where we either can't ever do it elsewhere, or we are losing our shirts, like only getting 30% for 100% of the effort.
Yep.
That's a dream. That's a dream killer right there. Yeah. That is a dream killer. And there is a place for that. And I think the place is those smaller publications. And honestly, if they're not IP focused, it's definitely drive through. Cause then if you're doing a $6 mini pamphlet of whatever it might be, and you put it on drive through and you're losing 70%, so you still maintain your IP, that's worth it. I think if it's six pages, it's something you put together, and I'm not saying bad, but I mean, and you might either commission art, or you might do some stock, or you may take art that you've already commissioned for other works or what have you. That's fine. I don't worry about that, but I worry about getting strong rules locked away. If we build a great rule system that we like, wow, this is amazing and fun, and people all over are going to have fun with it, I worry about locking that behind a curtain that we can't ever get it out of. And I think I share this with my friends here, that is the driving force behind finding another avenue. We chose Kickstarter, but it was less because we wanted Kickstarter, and more because we didn't want that lockdown.
And because one of the other things that really pushed us over the edge when we were trying to decide was, you mentioned earlier, you know, is it the right time to collaborate, et cetera, something that you like to share. But we started collaborating heavily and early with bringing other people on our shows and forming as many relationships as possible.
Yes.
And Kel and Scald from Awfully Queer Heroes put out, I don't know, maybe two Kickstarters a year, three Kickstarters a year. They're insane. They have like
three to four. Next, I think they're three right planned. Now, but yeah.
And they became really good friends. And they were talking to us, encouraging us and giving us advice and saying, hey, this is how we do it. We use Kickstarter. This is what we do. So that gave us that last piece to feel comfortable with the Kickstarter platform, as we had somebody else who'd walked this path before us, who could share some wisdom backwards and really give us a hand as we launched. Yeah. So that was a big piece of it, too.
Yeah.
And while we're talking about different.
Is that recognition on your face, by the way? Did you recognize Awfully Queer Heroes?
Yeah. No, I've messed with their Kickstarters. We I think like, and I ran into you guys, I think even before we kind of crossed paths a little on Danilo's show, was also just Twitter. Like, once you've been on Twitter for like 2 years in the TTRPG space, there's some faces you start to recognize as everyone else falls away. You guys and Awfully Queer Heroes were definitely in that, like, Follow Friday crew.
Well,
you know, and Zach, I was very familiar with your work and your wife's work. I picked up the, I never pronounce it correctly, but the one that begins with E. I had backed that.
Aragorn.
Aragorn.
Weird spelling. It's typical to fantasy. Okay.
But
not here, it's Aragorn.
Yeah, there you go. Aragorn was one of the ones I picked up because the artwork was really cool. I liked that style. I just kind of dug what was there. Mm. And in addition to that, I was like, hey, wait a minute, why do I know this name? And then it's like, oh, because we've commented and liked on several threads already. So it was like, okay, so we're already people. Like we kind of had these connections without knowing we had these connections. And then it was like a week later, I think I heard you on Danilo's show talking about Kickstarters and talking about projects and how you build these things. And a lot of those ideas on your second appearance, and then I went back and listened to your first appearance, were some of the ideas that we talked about a lot when we were doing our first one. And you spoke heavily about micro Kickstarters, these smaller ones. And I know our first Kickstarter, we had a fair amount of discussion about what's our goal going to be? What do we really want to do? And I said, our first thing.
I was a big scaredy pants. I was like, we're not going to make it.
We've got to come out of the gates with a success, one. And we had to find what that sweet spot between, is it too little that people are going to think it's not really worth it for what we're trying to do? Or is it too much that it's going to be too hard to get to? And I would be lying to everybody listening to the sound of my voice if I told you I'm now an expert at that. I think every Kickstarter is going to have its own issues with what's the right spot. And the only thing I've personally come to is, whatever your choice is, make sure you are accurate with your budget. Do not ever make a Kickstarter less than it's going to cost you to produce the project at the level you desire to produce it at. Win, lose, or draw, you will always lose if you do not do the, if you don't set that limit correctly. If you're like, I'm going to get all the greatest artists in the world to come on this book, get your pricing before you launch, because artists, reasonably and accurately and correctly so, are not cheap. Yes. You know, when we decided this project was going to have commissioned artists for all of the major pieces of the book, we said, what's that budget going to look like? Mm-hmm. What does that budget mandate at a minimum this Kickstarter goal has to be? And then we set out to do that. And we're like, okay, now that we have that, let's talk about advertising. What are we going to have to spend to advertise this to achieve these goals? Add that in. Then it's, what do we want to make over the top to get just a little bit more so we have some cushion over that? That's how we set our goals. And that has got to be the mechanism. I cannot imagine somebody, unless they just get lucky and capture lightning in a bottle, being successful if they're not doing that. Or you'll be one of those cautionary tales where you hear about folks who are like, you know, we're 2 weeks away from the close of the campaign and I have to shut the campaign down, even though we're about to hit goal, because we're not going to get much more than goal, which means I can't afford to do the project. We've all heard that scary story, and that happens when people do not set their budgets right and do not price accordingly. You got to know what your costs are to set your goal.
Yeah, your base goal needs to be enough to pay for your initial product, period. Even if it doesn't line your pockets, because none of our work does so far. None of us have drawn a paycheck from Tabletop Journeys yet. We just put everything back into it. Our budgets for Kickstarters at the moment are all allocated to things like art, printing costs, shipping costs. This one is big enough to have a small chance of having a little bit left over if we hit enough stretch goals. But we're not to the point yet where people know us enough to just throw money at us because we put up a project, because they already have faith it's going to be good, right? When you get to that point, when you can put up a project and you fund and you 300% fund in the first day and a half, well, you know, you've pretty much made it at that point. You're there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But
yep.
So awesome. So let's dig more into that first Kickstarter then. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and I'm pulling it up right here. So it's Multiverse of Subclasses. It was a $500 funding goal. You got $1,598 from 99, almost got 100.
I know.
Yeah, we were so close.
It's funny, actually. I was looking at, I remember, because I'm the cat that like sits there like watching the Kickstarter like all day, every day, like hitting the refresh button. How many backers have we got? How many backers have we got? Right. And I remember sitting there watching as that Kickstarter was ending, like 5 minutes to go. Cause I, you know, it was like in like the 95 range, kind of like heading into that last day. And I'm watching, it's getting up 96, 97, 98, you know, finally gets up to 99. And there's like 15 minutes left. And I'm like, I can't let it end on 99. Like I was going to go in and back my own book, right? To go ahead and get us up to 100, just because I thought that was a nice round number. And something went up with my internet, and I missed the deadline. Like I missed it. Cause I was sitting there, like I'm putting in my credit card number. I'm doing the thing. I think I may have been logged into like the company account instead of my personal account or whatever it was. And like, I'm trying to back. And then the Kickstarter ends. And I was like, oh, I missed it. You know, so like, so try to get the 100, but it's
a
bit,
that's a good disappointment to have for a Kickstarter. Yeah. Oh, I didn't get to add the 100th backer.
I know. And so we cheated a little bit on that one. I'll be honest. Yeah. I tried to cheat anyway. I just didn't cheat.
We failed.
Yeah,
right. I failed at the cheating.
Yeah,
that's right. You got like 300% funded. Failed.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Well, and that's a good point for everybody, is that, and I'm experiencing this right now with my own campaign, and I always do. I'm helping some other guys who are very much where you were before your Kickstarter, but like they didn't know, and they wanted, like they wouldn't have done it as soon as they did if they didn't have a person, someone who has already done it before, kind of guiding them through it. And they hit their funding goal in the first like 48 hours, and now it's kind of stalled out, and they're like. But what's winning now? Once you've funded, you know,
The middle doldrums are tough.
Right. Yeah, so
they are, yeah.
Yeah, and from what I've seen, with the possible exception of the giant companies, the Cobalt Presses, the Pathfinders of the world, the MCDMs of the world, with the exception of those folks, and I imagine their numbers by percentage actually do this also. But I what I've seen for us is there's a lot of activity in the first week. There's limited activity in the middle weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a little bit of activity but about half of what that first week's activity is in the final week. You know,
it's even more specific than that. Let me just kind of to put those round numbers on. You will do, I think, I'm trying to remember exactly what the percentage is, but you'll do something like 85% of your funding in the first 72 hours and the last 72 hours. And that is where all the magic happens. And I mean, certainly our first Kickstarter wasn't quite that way, because it funded in like 72 hours, right? It's funded in like 3 days. And then it just kind of like slowly ticked along until the very end. And then there was a little bit of a kick at the end, but not much, because pretty much by that point, everybody who knew us and wanted to get in on it had already gotten in on it. So that was great. This Kickstarter that we're currently in is definitely moving that way. And guys, do you mind if I give like some exact numbers on kind of what we're looking at? Is that,
yeah,
you
please.
That?
I'm fine with that.
So to put that in perspective, right? So it's a $3,000 goal. We were at $2,000 within 4 days.
Right.
We are now not quite at 2,500.
Yep.
So, and it's been almost 2 weeks.
That's going to say, like, how many? Yeah. And so like the first 4 days, you're at like 2,000. And then you've had another 6 days since then, a whole week.
Almost two weeks. Yeah.
Almost two weeks. And you're only up almost 500.
Another 500 since
four and change.
Yeah. So, and all that to go ahead and say that, like, I'm looking at these numbers, like, I actually think we're sitting pretty good. I think that will be okay. We're
with that last 72 hours. Yeah. I agree, but man, oh man, am I biting my fingernails back to the quick? We're only 80% funded, and we've got 10 days to go. So hey, if you're listening to this, and you're into a concept of a factions, but go back us.
well, there's plenty of time for plugging. Don't worry.
My bad.
I run my numbers is, if you're 80% funded by the last like the 48 hours mark. Unless you have an astronomically high goal, which you guys don't, unless like you have to cover like $250,000 or something, I feel like your chances of funding are really, really strong. How many people, if you don't mind sharing the number, do you have following the project? Because that's, I usually just take that and I turn that into like a 10% number that I in my experience, it's ranged everywhere from 5 to 25% of followers come in to back in that last 48 hours.
So we,
I think you broke up on us.
There we go. I think I'm okay now. Okay. So we have 107 project followers, and right now we're at a 20% conversion rate, which our conversion rate is actually pretty good.
That's really cool. That's great. Especially, you know, like before your campaign's even ended.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So, you know, so we're thinking that we're probably going to pick up 10 or 15 of those. It's kind of what I think we're going to go. Right. Maybe get like up over 30% would be nice. Yeah. You know, but that's kind of where, so we have a bunch of people following that haven't backed yet. So.
No, and that's like the way I tend to do my math in my head is like take your like average pledge level or what you consider your usual pledge, multiply that by the 10%. Even if you take your low $20 pledge level and you multiply that there's $200, you know, right there. That gets you a heck of a lot closer. I think you'll do better than that. And then it's a matter of like if you just did that, which I'm considering like bare minimum. All right, you guys would only need to make another $400, you know, just to cover your bare minimum number. So if you can cover $400 before the last 48 hours, at bare minimum, all right, being super conservative, you know, you guys should be good.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm very confident with you guys. So we're going to back up, all right, back to subclasses. So just talk to me about like when you were doing your first Kickstarter, all right? What were the difficulties? What were the surprises? You know, what were the mistakes that hindsight you brought and said, well, we're not doing that again versus like, oh, well, early birds are an automatic win. Like we're doing that every time. Like what were the big like losses or wins and lessons from it?
So I think one of the biggest wins was just that early birds as well as community copies. I won't take credit for the community copy idea. That was Josh that brought that to the table, but absolutely adore that idea. One of the things that we have, and it continues to be a winner for us, but one of the things that we're gonna try to figure out how to improve that a bit is how to advertise that particular thing. And for explanation purposes, what that is we set a number of digital copies of this book aside that are at a reduced cost, roughly half. And I think it's a little bit around half, half cost, because we don't want money to be a barrier for entry in this project. We don't want people to say, man, those Tabletop Journeys guys seem really good, but $20 is a scratch I can't afford to itch, or itch I can't afford to scratch, right? So what we've done is we've said, let's set aside a portion of copies at this reduced cost. But what we also did as an add-on is allow anybody who backs at the regular level, they can then buy a community copy, and that actually funds more community copies in the kitty. So whatever we started with is not the total number, because every person who backs has the ability to create more for more engagement with more people.
Yeah, to basically buy the other half, yeah.
And one of the things that I was thinking is, especially in a book where we're doing a print copy of this book that has both storyteller and player applications, is the DM at the table can buy the hard copy book for himself. He'll get a digital as a part of that. Right. But then his players could turn around and buy community copies, or he could buy a couple community copies and say to his players, hey, I put some skin in the game for you. How about you go back? So now each of you has a copy of this. So when you want to do your own faction, you have your own copy to do this. And that was kind of our mentality, is because we recognize that little thing that folks at WotC even talk about. DMs put the bulk of the money into this game because they have to buy all the resources to build a campaign. Players don't typically keep buying more and more things unless you get products that are not very focused towards that end. So when you have a product that applies to both, how do we accomplish that? And so this is one of those ways that we can do that we've found to do that. the magic now is, now that we know it works, now that we know that it's a good thing and a lot of people like it, I think Josh can tell you what the number is we have sold on of community copies on this, on this particular project. But now that we know that, the idea is, how do we talk to the wider audience and let them know that that's here? Because I'm not sure that everybody who does Kickstarter knows that or understands how that works. Like, they, I don't think they get what that means. Like, they either think, oh, this is a cheaper copy and that's it, or they don't understand, hey, I'm a person with means. I want to go ahead and take care of somebody else who might not, because I want to build this community. I want more people to game. I want more people to have access to greater and better gaming tools. So we got to figure out how to get that talked about. And I think shows like this provide a great opportunity to talk about that mechanism. So other people out there doing Kickstarters, consider doing something like that. And talk with other Kickstarters, other content creators, you know, join that community where we're sharing ideas about how to do it, not just our content, like, here's a cool thing I'm doing from an advertising standpoint, but here's how we're making the sausage. I've got some extra fennel seeds for yours,
right?
You know, something like that. That's kind of where I think the conversation kind of needs to go at some point. So that's the piece that we're going to be working on over the next year towards the next project.
I love that. Let me take a pause from as a consumer, because I did back your campaign before I came here. I backed at the community PDF level. And of course, I'm like, I'm in a hurry and I'm about to go to work. You guys just launched a campaign. I want to do something. And I can always change my pledge level later. So I'm start always by just like, what's the like bare minimum to get like a good thing off of it? And I just read it as like community copy, PDF, $10. Oh, it's like we have some half price community copies, but it includes the PDF. Okay, $10. Done. Obviously, because it's just a price. And I can always change it later and see what those bigger pledge levels are about, you know. But it that I think that just kind of shows the consumer journey of like they want to know what the price is, what the number is. Yeah. And if you're not in a leisurely place, you know, you're not going to take your time. And that there's absolutely, I love the mechanism. I think that there's a lot of room to do some consumer education on that and kind of lay it out, whether that's in a video or an infographic that you can just put in a Kickstarter update and on your social media of like, here's a way of like paying it forward and extending the ladder and making sure that for your price conscious consumer, they have and that there's an avenue there as long as they're, you know, on the ball. And for the charitable consumer or the one that's not as price conscious, that they can give the support and support the community at large.
Yeah.
I just love the whole concept. And I think you do a good job of saying like, well, you do limit it, you know, so that it's not just a free for all, because we know that like pay what you want is a nice concept until nobody pays.
Right.
You know? And that this was, I think you're building a really interesting mechanism. And that it
until nobody pays. Yeah.
Once people are educated, it could be better than the early bird, because on top of it being a good deal for some people, it's emotionally rewarding.
Yeah.
You know, for everybody. Because if you're backing the $10, you say the community cares about me. And if you're backing at the higher and you're giving back to the community, you say I care about the community. And there's just a lot of love that it's the whole reason I went to the TTRPG community.
Well stated. That like summarized the whole thing very well. That's exactly the intent behind it.
Yeah. Copy, paste it, put it in a promo. Steal it. I give it to the community.
Perfect.
So I love that. That was one of the things you learned was the community copy. What else did you take away from that first Kickstarter that you brought into the second?
So I would say the two biggest things that we learned were less about the actual technicalities of and minutia of the Kickstarter process. And they're a little bit more higher level, but they were everything takes longer than you think it's going to. Everything from the writing to the editing, to the finishing, to the layout, to the art collection, all of it's going to take you longer than you think it's going to. That was one. So allow yourself a little bit more time for each task. And the other one, both these play right into organization, was that we had to be organized up front and have a very clear picture of the product we were creating. Mm-hmm. And I say that because for subclasses of the multiverse, we said, okay, we're writing subclasses. Everybody go. and we separated into isolation, and we all wrote subclasses, and none of them matched in terms of format, form, theme, anything.
Which meant we had real paladins,
right. Which meant we had some really cool stuff, but it also meant that before it could become one cohesive book, we had to rewrite it all.
Yeah.
To make it
the analogy I use for that exact thing, because we've done that same thing where we're like, okay, everybody, here's the setting, come up with ideas, is that I actually take it from Project Runway. this is the fashion show. Tim Gunn says it all needs to look like it comes from the same closet, you know. Yep. And I use that same analogy, like it all needs to come from the same bookshelf.
Yep.
All right. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't look like it can live on the same bookshelf, you're doing something wrong.
Right. It can have different tone, it can have different information, but it's got to have an overall matching theme, voice,
look,
something to bring it all together into one volume.
And to follow that, what we did with that information, because we learned the lesson, but then what we had to do is apply the lesson. And what we applied in this one is, before we get started writing, we basically started with little paragraph ideas, and then we did what we call a cut meeting. Okay. Yep. We knew kind of about how many factions we wanted. So we had a bunch of ideas in this little paragraph blurb, mini elevator pitch. They weren't even a full 2-minute elevator pitch, really. They were actually fairly small. I think a lot.
Paragraph or two.
Yeah, I think some of them came in well under 1,000 words, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like
1,000 words is a full page. Like, none of them were
I think one of them was like 4 lines.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. But we basically did that, and then we said, okay, where do we want to go with that? And then we got, once we had that list, then we said, stop, nobody write. Now let's come up with a format for each faction that we're going to publish with.
A template, if you will.
A template.
Of information
then
that we want.
Then we finalized. Largely, there's a couple nuances that we have to tweak, but once that was done, then it's like, now everything we have, let's start moving it to these templates, and now we can go, and now we have a book that's going to seem much more cohesive. Right. Our last book came together very nicely, but this is going to be, this is actually starting in a better place to get there.
Yeah, we and did a lot of work to get there. Yeah,
the result is doing that work on the front half of the project before we even put up our pre-launch video means we don't have to do that level of effort on the back end. So from campaign close to delivery, we've shortened that time frame considerably. And that's so the application of that lesson was
we hope
almost as much as, and well, whatever it comes up being, I guarantee you it's shorter than
it'll be better than it would have been if we didn't. Yeah,
so
hell yeah.
I can guarantee that's that was at least a month and a half to 2 months of work that we took care of in about 2.5-3 weeks just by not writing, getting a template first.
Yep.
That's it's a creative process. Most people understand the creative. The process is a necessary part of that equation. Creative without the process is chaos.
Yeah.
You know, process without creative is accounting. And that you don't want to sell that. You need both.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, we have some, the three of us have a background that really covers those grounds, right? Mm-hmm. I'll let Josh talk about his background specifically, but me, I've been in customer care and sales nearly my entire life. Sales, a major portion of what I do. So the idea of creating cohesive stories, ideas, putting things out there to help people understand what we're asking of them, and making things easier for people to access. That's kind of the background I bring to the table. I also do, because I work in a pretty fast moving customer care environment, I deal a lot with logistics. So a lot of the, how do we get the pieces and parts to flow together so things come out in the right order, in the right time frame. So it puts me in a realm to understand that. Josh does project management and stuff like that. I'll let him talk about his piece.
Yeah. I mean, I was a software engineer for 20 something years, and then I now in software engineering management, so I get to go ahead and mentor other software engineers, which is managing software engineers is a hoot. It's a totally different world than doing the thing. But yeah, so I mean, I'm very much kind of like not logistics. I wouldn't necessarily call it logistics, but definitely kind of in that process mindset a lot, where it's like everything kind of builds on itself, right? We're all just bricks in the wall, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's very much the world that I live in on a daily basis.
Awesome. So, yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say there's a good bit of Josh giving us the pieces and parts that we need, me trying to apply a GUI interface so that it's accessible, and Glenn managing both of us to make sure that we're both, like, our ideas are meshing together well. Yeah. And I think that helps us a lot with these types of things. Glenn, who did a lot of the heavy lifting on the rewrites on the last book, he was the driving force behind the need for that process improvement.
Yeah.
And so,
like, I'm not doing that again. We have to make it better.
So once that was said, then it's like, okay, so how do we do that?
How do we do
and
it?
Then it was process in place. We've got better spreadsheets to tell where we are. Our editing process is going to be smoother this time, because mm-hmm. we actually took the time to take our document where we would go chapter by chapter, topic by topic, where they are, each piece is in the editing process, which got very confusing deep in on the last one.
Yeah.
And we have a much better process for that. So, like, we literally took everything we did to build the actual thing last time around and said, what do we need to improve? How do we get it improved? Here's the new process. And then we shared it and said, okay, this will work, before we got going on this project.
Yeah.
And on the upside, I come from a mid-level management, process improvement, project management, operations logistics background.
Six Sigma, yeah.
I ran teams of drivers for all the way through final mile delivery and all kinds of craziness, routing for technicalities. But that bit goes well into the helping manage it all and put all the pieces together. So between the three of us, we make a surprisingly well-rounded team, picking up each other's weaknesses.
No wonder you guys are able to put out such good stuff in what I consider an insane amount of time. You know, like, I was like, is it just that there's three of them and they don't sleep?
That helps. If there's three of us, we've talked to so many single or double or even partnerships out there that are struggling with time, because it's a lot, especially if you're running a podcast and content creation. So the fact that there's three of us is huge.
This is my way to not have a podcast, is I just do, like, talk with people whenever I can with no, I'll see you guys next Friday. None of that. Okay. Because I could never dedicate that much time just to do a podcast. And then on top of that, you guys are putting quality work together in what I consider to be a pretty constricted time frame. All right, to get it all together, make it good, and then have room to breathe.
Yeah,
and running a pretty hefty content distribution on the back end of that.
I mean, here's the other thing that you may or may not be aware of. In addition to that, each of us does other work freelance as well. So, like, I did an editing job this summer while we were producing one of our books and preparing for this Kickstarter. During that process, I edited on a project as well. Yeah. And I've been picking up other jobs here or there. Generally,
right in the middle of the last one, we did a group project with Splitterverse.
Exactly. Yeah, we did. Yeah. We did
a collaboration with
another book.
Yeah, we did a whole chapter in another book for on DMs Guild for another publishing house. You know, and we say it all the time. If somebody's interested in us doing some work, we manage our schedule based on our project as primary, and then what we can fit in around there. So, you know, what the turnaround time is, what the page count is, what the level of work is, all of that does play into whether or not we take a job. Because the idea is, obviously, don't take a job you can't complete.
Right.
Fills everything.
Yeah. But I mean, to put that kind of all in perspective, I'm just kind of answer the time question too. So, you know, and I'm not saying this to go ahead and, like, flop and, like, say, oh, how big I am, right? You know, but I was up. So today's Friday. It's an episode day. I did not queue up today's episode last night because I decided to go to bed at a reasonable hour instead.
Okay.
Today I was up. Yeah, right. But today I was up at 5 o'clock this morning because episode needed to get primed. It needed to get set up. Needed to get put into we use a WordPress hosted website that does all of our distribution for us. But then there's all the social media pushes, and then there's the video. Now we're doing video up on YouTube, so there's that preparation. So, you know, I mean, from 5 until 8. night when my daughter woke up and I was up with her for half hour, 45 minutes before I go to work every day, was podcast time, you know, was doing the needful to go ahead and get today's episode up, and everything like that. And then there was also some promo video stuff for the Kickstarter, like, we're trying to go ahead and like hit that mid campaign plateau, trying to go ahead and get some excitement and doing some things. And so there was a big announcement today, just trying to push through a little bit, you know. But I get up early. I mean, that's kind of what I do. And that like magic time, that 5 to 8 hour, that's kind of that's my magic time. So
And then this weekend, one of the things we didn't mention in this particular about this particular Kickstarter is in addition to us finally getting around to doing printed books, we also have a retailer's tier. One of the things that concerned us doing all digital work, a big problem with DM's Guild and Drive-Thru, by the way, is that how do you promote your project and the things you're doing at your local game store when that's right. their competition?
Who we want to support. We don't
Who
want,
we
all
want
of
to support,
to
right?
just be online.
So the answer for us is, put in a retailer's tier, and so we had to find a way to do that, provide them a means to be able to make a little hay themselves, and do that. So we have what we feel is a really good support level based on retailers coming in and buying a set of books that they can sell on their shelves. And if they want to have additional books, that comes with discounts as well, so they can so that we don't have to feel guilty about doing something that's competing with the mom and pop shops and the FLGSs that are out there. So my weekend this weekend, now that we're in this particular phase, is to really start hitting both digitally and physically all the game stores that are within the sound of my voice or the reach of my feet and wheels to let them know this is here.
Right, because word of mouth is pretty much all we've got on that, to try to spread it.
And I'll be honest, I used to own a comic book store years and years ago. And this was long before digital. I didn't do gaming at all. I actually stayed out of that space because I didn't want to compete with my game store. I had been going to that game store since I was like 8. And when I at 17 or 18 bought the comic book store, I didn't want to compete with them. So I did comics. Pat actually stopped doing comics around that time, so I could send gaming folks down there and I could meet them when I closed the shop and game or whatever, and vice versa. So we did not compete. And I feel very strongly that that was always the right choice to make. But my experience in that business is when you run your own business, anything that encroaches on your area scares you.
Yep.
And you are reticent to talk about it, allow it, propagate it, make it. So for those who are out there getting ready to do Kickstarters, once you're out of the level where you're all digital, if it is within your means to do so, I would, even if it doesn't sell a single tier, I would recommend getting that tier in there so you can talk to your stores about not being scared about Kickstarter. Kickstarter doesn't have to be the death of the FLGS. Look, there's a couple big companies, begins with the initial W, ends with the initial C, that are perfectly willing to cancel all the FLGSs out there, right?
And they're like actively looking for ways to
eliminate. And they have made it without putting it in print. They have made it their mission statement, right? We know that's what they're trying to do. We in the third-party market content creation, or even those in the second-party content creation, don't have to join that bandwagon. We can do things differently, and we can do things responsibly. You know, we can find printers who are environmentally sound and make all those right decisions. We can involve ourselves with other partners who treat people decently, are inclusive, and all of these things. We can partner with other companies and organizations. We can do content for companies that do really well, that are really, really community-minded in general, but we can also do things that benefit those FLGSs. Unfortunately, by word of mouth, we've got to collectively talk to those FLGSs. Once that starts rolling, once a store gets that, you know, if you're doing a Kickstarter and you've got 60 people, my guess is a bunch of those are relatively physically close to you. And those are probably the ones that are going to be able to go to some of your local stores. If you're walking into a store and said, hey, I can run some demos here on a Sunday, I can bring in some folks or what have you, I'm asking you to back for about $4 to put them on your shelf for X. You know, that's something you can do. But again, you got to make that commitment. You got to be a member of that community. You got to be at those stores on a regular basis. You got to support those stores on a regular basis. You know, when you go to your conventions, you got to send people their way, you know, that kind of thing. You know, when a relatively local convention was, and not actually terribly local, next state away, came up, we had the opportunity to go a little bit closer for Glenn and I than for Josh. Glenn and I attended there, but part of that was, you know what? I patronized some of those shopkeepers, some things that were maybe not needs, but they were certainly cool to have and interesting to have. But that's what you do to build your community. You take care of the folks that are around you so that we can all grow and get better and be better together.
Yeah, 100%. All right. So shifting gears a little bit, love the talk, by the way, but zoning back in to you guys. So we learned a little bit about the first Kickstarter, which was the multiverse of subclasses. You learned a lot from that. You took it to this new one. You have 10 days to go. You have about only $500.
About $500, yep.
500, a little over that, to get to the next spot. So talk to me about, you know, what was different about this launch. You guys went from a $500 to a $3,000 funding goal.
Yeah.
It also looks like the art is solid for this one. So just talk about like what was different going into this one, what brought you to that $3,000, and to getting that much more money, you know, that now you're over by your last one by $1,000 with more to come for sure. Talk to me about the differences.
Boy. So I think the biggest thing in terms of, Luminica talked a lot about kind of like how we structured the budget earlier.
He's breaking out on us. Luminica, you want to step in?
Yeah, so
in the show and how we kind of came to that $3,000 figure. And I really appreciate that your point.
And he's gone.
Go ahead. No, my internet, I think, is effing up. So, yeah.
Drop your camera, see if it helps you.
I'm going to back out and come back in, Zach.
Okay. We're going to switch you over to Leewanika.
All right.
Keep yours.
And so that's.
So the answer to your question is really a three-letter word, art. Our decision was, because while everybody in the world was dealing with the OGL crisis, kind of behind the scenes and went, I think, a little too far under the radar, is the AI art revolution. And we came to some really interesting and troubling revelations. We had in our first book used stock art, which was responsibly sourced. We went to the best sources we possibly could at the price points that we could afford for our project. That allowed us to do a project that was budgeted correctly at the $500 level and then stretch goals following from there.
Right.
When we started hearing about the AI art issues, including what happened in the Giants book, which was a little bit later on and so on, one of the things we did, because I spend a lot of time listening to shows, podcasts like Marketplace, Make Me Smart, and I do a lot of business page reading, and I read a lot of business articles and stuff, you know, subscribe to some web articles and things like that on the business standpoint of things, specifically including AI. One of the things I caught was an article by the Shutterstock president or CEO who made some comments about AI art that I found terribly disturbing, which is basically, it's here to stay. I'm going to keep using it. And what I realized is not every stock art company identifies what's AI or not. And so we had to then go, we have been using a stock art company. Do they identify? We have since found out that they do. So we feel much better about that. But I don't know if they did all the way along. I think that's something that happened in the last year, right? Mm-hmm. So now we have to be even more careful. And what we decided was that if we have commissioned art, And the more commissioned art we have, the less we have to worry about the research and the deep research on that issue. And so when you ask about that $3,000 budget, almost all of that is to factor in the art we wanted for the book.
And to account for the fact that we now offer a printed offering. That's new and first this first time this Kickstarter. Yeah. Between our last Kickstarter and this one, Josh took the initiative to take several of our other projects and work on their layout and then pay to have them test printed to make sure that we had a handle on how to lay out for print and preparation for this. But offering a printed product significantly increases your costs.
And I'll also just tack on to there, because I do believe that AI needs to be a hard discussion. I've kind of just sworn off any AI imagery for, I think, obvious reasons. It's theft with more steps. All right.
Right.
I'm just going to argue for anyone who, if that's not enough of an argument for you, then just listen to the fact of you don't own it. Okay. That right there, that AI art, you don't own it. That right now the legalese is shaking up that no matter how much work you put into generating it, even the generator doesn't own it. All right. And if anyone does own it, it's not you, it's the generator. And if it's not the generator, it's the artist whose pieces made up the art. All right. And that's legally speaking, not morally speaking, that's legally speaking. And what you guys have the opportunity to do, we invested in an amazing artist for my wife's cover. Her name's Maria Domova. If you've seen my wife's cover, it's a banger. All right. Yeah. It is beautiful. And the reason I was willing to shell out what was, for me at the time, a significant amount of money to pay a professional artist to pay for the cover of a book that hadn't fully been written yet, okay, was that I knew the art was something I could sell later in repackaged formats. And I can only do that if I own the rights to it, all right? Yeah. And I paid the premium to own the rights for that. But that's coasters, that's mugs, it's t-shirts, it's bags, it's bookmarks. It can, that the money opportunities for long-term ownership of a valuable, beautiful intellectual property, like a well-done piece of art, way outstrips any money you're going to save by using AI art you don't even own. And that right. might come back around and say, whatever money you made, we get a cut, because you took a cut of our art, we take a cut of your money.
Right. All right.
That just from not even business ethics, just business economics, it is a bad decision to go with AI art. And I wanted to just get on my TED Talk stool. All right. And
so we are.
I have to talk to people about the difference between moral economics and moral ethics. And if I can make ethics economical, then I get more people on my side.
Right.
And just a side note, if you happen to be really into generating AI art, because I could see how your technical mind could get really into coming up with the prompts and the creation process. If you happen to be really into it, it can be done ethically. All you have to do is undertake the monumental task of making sure that every artist and IP owner in your database that it takes its selections from agrees to be in it, as opposed to using an AI software source that just uses a general database where they did not get permission.
Scrape the internet,
or they scraped whatever sources they had that they got. You know,
right. But even just proving that complicated web of permission is so convoluted, it's not even funny.
And it's also important to note that while we were having these discussions in-house and figuring out what we wanted to do, and we were all very much in lockstep about the want, what it literally came down to is, so how can we do what we want at the price point we want? And so one of the things we did is we went to the legitimately sourced stock art company that we subscribed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent, because I kind of took the lead on this part of the project for a bit, I spent the better part of 2 weeks put together, like, I can't even count how many photos I put together. So many photos to go through, and then said, let's pick the ones we like, and then we'll start contacting those artists and ask them to hire on. So all of the artists we have also do stock art, which we had previously paid for at this project and previous project, but they were people whose artwork we had seen, we had liked, and then we reached out to them and came to agreements on what on the commission. And what a wonderful experience.
That is so smart.
What a wonderful experience dealing with the artists that we have.
Yeah.
They, one, absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
The cover of this book literally brought me to tears when I first saw it. I actually said, did we honestly just pay for something that good? Like, yeah, how did we do that? Like, how did we successfully get that cover? It is so good. And then all of a sudden we start looking at all these sigils but in the back of my head, I think about, like we said, creativity and process. We put a lot of effort on the creative side to find the things that we like and the concepts, the styles we like. Mm-hmm. And then we put our process mind to that. How do we go ahead and get in touch with them? We created our lists, our top to bottom. Here are the people we wanted to go to. And I got to tell you, the people we got were our first choices. Mm-hmm. So don't think that we got, like, we asked 30 people and we only got the last five. That is not the case.
Yeah.
No, artists are out there looking for work. If you ask them, they will want to work with you.
And I have a sense that if we had been turned down by any of them, it would have been more because they were actually already doing something less than they did.
They're already busy. Yeah.
Right. That they couldn't fit you in your time frame.
Yeah.
And right. I just want to brag about you for a moment. What an excellent idea to go after highly qualified artists and say, not only do we love their art, but we know that they're willing to sell it to a stock company. And if they're willing to sell it to these people, why wouldn't they be willing to work with us, who are going to put more love into it, who are going to make sure that they're compensated well, who we can be reoccurring customers? That's such an excellent idea that seems obvious in hindsight.
Yep.
But somehow I never thought of it. And I just wanted to brag on you guys for just having good sense.
Let me go ahead and take you one more step down the road about how good sense that really is, Zach, is that so not only have we commissioned custom art for this book from those artists, mm-hmm. but because we have access to their stock art, we're going to be able to do something with this book that we have not been able to do on any of the other three. There's going to be a cohesive art style throughout the entire thing, even though not all of it is directly commissioned, right? So it helps. As the guy that does the layout, it really helps me on the other side, because I know that, like, oh, if I go to these three artists and I look at all their stuff and I find anything that I like, I know that it will look and feel like the other stuff in the book, right?
In fact, that's where we should start when we're looking for the stock art to fill in the extra pages, is with the artists we're already working with for that reason, and it's fantastic. Exactly.
And the fact that the artists are getting their commission, mm-hmm. and whatever they get through the stock art company, because we're picking up their works as well, they're constantly being taken care of. And look, this is not the first and only project we're going to do with these artists. I can guarantee that. They are phenomenal to work with.
You know, that's been the amazing thing is, honestly, if anything, I'm afraid, like, I just hope you don't get hit by a bus, because we need
that's my biggest fear,
you know. And,
totally.
But it's a good problem to have. I am much happier with high quality art from a high quality person who's getting quality pay. It's been amazing to work with. She's taken direction. We're not settling for what's on a stock library. We are getting exactly what my wife, who's the author, who's put so much work into the book itself, wants. And everyone just walks away clean and happy, and it's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm going to rein it back in, all right, because we can take side quests all day long.
We're masters of it.
All right, so let's kind of narrow it down to this. Okay, so you went from a micro, and you said, look, we're ready for something bigger. All right, well, what would be your advice to someone who's like, they've only done $100 to $500 Kickstarter campaign, it was successful, but they want to aim for something bigger down the road? What is your advice? You've given some of it. Feel free to rehash.
So number one, always set your budgets accurate to your cost. That's my number one piece of advice with Kickstarter. And I'm by no means an absolute expert, but that cures all ills. You're either going to succeed and be able to do the thing, or you're not going to succeed, and then you'll have to find some way to go back to the drawing board and come back with a new project down the road. But at the very least, when done, you'll be able to do the thing. And I think that's very key to growth. You have to be able to respond to your promises in an adequate amount of time, and that comes with proper budgeting to begin with. The next thing I would say is be careful with advertising. There's a lot of things that sound wonderful that are not as wonderful. Now, I'm a scaredy cat with advertising. I don't understand the internet as well as I probably could or should. Fortunately, we're a three-party team, so we do have Josh, who really gets the nuts and bolts a lot better, but even he will tell you we're learning lessons all the time. And there's a lot of trial and error. Like, okay, we put this money into here, but make sure when you're doing advertising, you have a means to check your numbers.
And look at your ROI afterwards and see what worked and what didn't.
There are so many pieces of that. There is how many people see it. There's how many people engage with it. There's how many conversions you get, and what's your ROI when you're done with it. Those four things, if you do not know what they're going to be upfront when you buy the advertising, you are taking a larger risk.
Yep.
Advertising in general is a risk, but you are taking a larger risk if you don't have, if the person you're advertising with cannot give you some information along those lines. That doesn't
let me just kind of add on to that for just a second here. Information is absolutely key in that, but so is knowing when you're riding a dead horse, right? Yeah. So if we started with an ad campaign, and it's going to be a prolonged ad campaign that we were expecting to get, like, we were aiming for like a 2.5 revenue over ad spend, right?
Mm-hmm.
First day was great, but that was the first 24 hours, so I'm not really sure how applicable that number really is. Day two, tanked. I mean, like, bad. I haven't even told them this number. Bad, right? and so we stopped. We stopped putting money into that funnel. It wasn't working. We needed to be a lot higher. Like, if we'd got the 0.5, we'd be funded already, you know? And we didn't. So, you know, so it's kind of like, you got to know. You know, it's like Roger said, you get no one to hold them and no one
to fold them.
Like and don't be afraid to make either decision. If you're a really hot ad campaign going on, let it roll,
Within your budget, but hit it.
Within your budget, right.
Yeah. So I what I would say is any situation, and I'm not the guy who knows how to do this, but if you have somebody in your camp who does know how to do this, any situation where you get to create unique click-throughs on said advertising so that you can see those numbers and you're not dependent on them telling you those numbers, do that. Be very wary of when you do not have the ability to see your numbers. If you can't see your own eyes, engagement, and ROI, and conversion and ROI, if you can't see that all on your own without depending on them, I would be concerned. They should either be able to give you something so that what you see matches. And I don't mean they give it to you after. I mean, you need to be able to, as Josh said, look at that real time and be able to see those numbers as it's happening so you can make those decisions on the fly. So one of the things, which brings me to a big piece of advice, is have a team. Don't do this thing solo. Don't do this alone. Have somebody who can handle the elements you can't handle. But also engage with folks. It can't just be about pushing the product. It's also got to be put up a silly meme. Hope, one of our TTRPG family members who we have worked with for a long time, and we've been patrons of her Patreon for quite a while. Talk also on Dan Olo's show about the fact that one of the things that she does that she recommends for people who are in the content creation or the podcast creation situation is quote unquote shit post. You know, some days it's, hey, I had a bacon cheeseburger today and ooh, did I love it. You know, some, you know, try to be upbeat, try to do whatever, but just talk about the life you live or talk about the things that are funny. Talk about the shows you're watching. You know, I'm prepping for a home game recently, so I've been goofing around on Hero Forge. They're not sponsors. I don't make any money from anybody who goes to them or what have you, but I toyed around with the new facial things on Hero Forge and posted that last night because I've got a big game coming up and the new NPC bad guy. And I'll be posting on that about that for a couple of days. You know, so do these other things, ask questions of people and, you know, go to other Kickstarters, patronize other Kickstarters, talk to other folks and hit up those podcasts that are in your avenue and see if they are willing to talk to you. Some are paid and then you have to work that into your ad budget. Many are not paid. If they like your project and they've got space in their schedule, if you hit them early enough, they can oftentimes get something done and have it out during that slow middle campaign period to help get you a couple more clicks. If you can get two or three more that you wouldn't have had, or three or four more, or four or five more during those middle weeks, that's awesome. You just got to hit, you got to plan for that.
Yep.
Can I? One thing I would add on really, oh, I was just going to have a really quick add on.
Okay, go ahead.
Really quick add on. When you're recruiting for a team, if you're out there by yourself or there's two of you and you know you need help, when you know you're looking to bring in a couple of more people, recruit for what you need. One of the most basic concepts of team building is to recruit people that fill in where you're weak. So if you're an excellent writer and have a crazy creative mind, but what you struggle with is the technology side of it, you need to recruit a Josh. Mm-hmm. If you know, you've got the creativity and the technical side covered and you really need a sales guy, though he's also very creative, you need to recruit a Lee. Recruit for where you're weak. If you need somebody to help with layout, as opposed to if you know someone you might be able to recruit into your project versus paying them, that's how you should set up your planned recruitment.
Awesome. I have some thoughts on the team thing, but I want to back up to the advertising real quick. So what advertising outlets are you willing to share today? And if it's zero, that's okay. But I know that if I were listening, I'd be like, okay, great. So you had 2.5 return for even 2 days. Like, if you're willing to share, I want to know who that is. Because just to give you a quick background on me is that I'm still figuring out paid ads, specifically on Facebook, mostly just because of ease of use. And I tried podcasting and I just found out that my product wasn't the right product for podcast ads. That just because you listen to the ad or you listen to a podcast doesn't necessarily mean you want to go buy my particular materials.
Yeah. Right.
And I tried that with like seven different for a Kickstarter. It just wasn't for me. I'd use trackable links so that I could see my return. And it just didn't pan out for me, but I tried. For Facebook, I've been willing until very recently to be willing to, within a budget, lose money on revenue returns because I look at lifetime customer value, where I say, hey, I might have spent $11 to acquire you to buy my $10 product, but I know that I have like a 1 in 3 chance because my product is good of getting you to come back to me. So if this equation keeps going with 10 more people, I'll make my money back the second time I sell.
I'll let Josh go on this. And then I've got a little caveat because we've been doing some specific discussion and research in this issue this very week.
Yeah.
Like it has been a big pain point. Do you think that's a fair way to say it?
Yeah,
Josh?
I think that's fair.
It's been a pain point this week and specifically regarding Facebook advertising.
Okay, good. So I'll just start with this just to set the stage. Anything you're not willing to talk about, I know you've like partnered with Jell-O or you've done other advertising.
Yeah.
That's okay. Be vague. Anything you're willing to give, I want, because I know that it's going to be valuable to the listeners.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem with that. I mean, that's for one, our partnership with Jell-Up is on our Kickstarter page. So it's no secret that we use Jell-Up. Jell-Up has been an interesting partnership. And then we got to them, I think, later than we needed to. And so I'm not sure that we necessarily were able to reap all the benefits from them that we could have. They also have very aggressive spending limits that you need to put into advertising to leverage their services, right? Because, I mean, as you can imagine, Jellup makes money when their creatives send people to our campaign and those people give us money. That's how Jellup gets a cut of that, right? That's okay. How they make money. So, you know, which is totally cool. I actually really liked their funding model. I thought their funding model was really advantageous to us because the better we did, the better they did, which works out for us really, really well. The one thing that, again, was kind of eye-opening is how aggressive they wanted us to go ahead and spend ad spend. I'm not going to quote the numbers exactly, but they're aggressive. I know, like, their day one ad spend they wanted was $400 a day in Facebook ads, and for it to escalate up to $100 a day for the first week, right? So day one's 400, day two is 500.
A lot of people's whole budget, and then
that's more than our Kickstarter funding, exactly, right? So that's why when you're thinking like $10,000, $20,000, $25,000 campaigns, they're spending $10,000 to $12,000 in advertising for that campaign, right? So that's where that number is kind of coming from, is because of, you know, and Jellup is great. The creatives that they put out are great. They've been a fantastic resource to us on a lot of levels. Like I said, I think that we just got to them later than we needed to go ahead and kind of best leverage what it was that they were doing. So that's kind of thing.
Josh, if I can just jump in at this point, I think the answer there, or at least something that we're considering, is Jellup the best resource for a campaign that's at our dollar amount,
right,
versus
exactly
a higher dollar amount.
Yeah.
If we're doing a $10,000 or $15,000 one, I think they're absolutely the answer, no question. Yep. Just based on the things that worked really well for us. Yep. But the amount of that aggression that Josh is speaking about is not an unsavory amount. It's not a confiscatory amount. I think they're a great company.
It just is what it is. Yeah.
It's just that I guess I don't necessarily need to go put Rolls Royce tires
on a Honda Accord.
On a Honda Accord. It can be El Camino's a great car because I love those, right? My buddy's dad had one for years, right? But, you know, it's a great car. They look great and it's all well. And I might want white walls, but I don't need them to be Rolls Royce white walls.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we made a bad decision because we got great information, and I'm very positive for that. But what I would say to anybody looking at a service like Jellup is consider where you are. If you're funding less than $3,000, that may or may not be the best thing to do. You got to look at your own, what you're willing to spend, what you can do naturally, what you can do through other means, and consider whether that's the best ad spend for you at that level.
Yeah.
If not, project two, maybe project three or four. Yeah. It really depends on where you are.
So, and then I'm kind of on top of that. We've done kind of a bunch of like kind of targeted advertising. So like, we did do, sorry, was that?
You froze up there.
You skipped.
Oh,
so I was waiting internet for you. I'm like, he's going to come in. I'm just got to give him like 2 seconds. There he is.
I know. I'm really sorry. Like, normally my internet is not this bad. I think it's Zoom. I don't think Zoom likes my computer, but that's anyway, I'll have to go ahead and say, we also did a bunch of like targeted things. Like we Facebook groups that will like put posts up to go ahead and show off our stuff, and like YouTube videos and stuff like that. Like, they'll make a YouTube video advertisement for us. I think the jury is out on how effective they may or may not have been. Mm-hmm. I think that jury's out. And I'm not sure I would necessarily go back to it.
I think the answer for some of those is, on some of those mechanisms, we didn't have all four of those things that I talked about earlier. And when you don't have all four of those things, you can't truly, evaluate its level of success.
Right.
And you're really guessing. Like, we're hoping that when we're done with this campaign, we're going to be able to send out a survey and people can kind of tell where they came from and get that last bit, circle the wagons and get that last bit of data that we need to say, okay, that, you know, of the people who actually backed, at least this is what they're telling us. So that's definitely the horse we want to go with. You know, we have we have all these other data points that we can kind of put into the matrix, and we have these final data points from the people who actually paid money versus came and took a look. And, you know, but again, survey adoption is really the key. So advice for other Kickstarters out there, if you've backed anything, fill out those surveys.
Yeah.
Do that. The more information you can provide other content creators, the more information that's out there for all of us, and then share that information, you know, without giving away 100%, and I don't think there's any trade secrets here, but to some extent, if we find out that some of our natural advertising was more successful than the others, then, you know, we might be able to spend more money there, or we might be able to put more money into a gel up if we know these other things are complete dogs, because we did put some money into these other things. That money at gel up, even if it's not 100% where we want to be for the level we're at, it could still do more. So we have to look at that and kind of take a look at it. So ask good survey questions, provide, and hopefully, and encourage your backers to provide adequate and accurate survey responses.
Yep. And I'll just tag onto there for that whole, like, how do you measure links? Cause not every like podcast is going to be able to tell you like, oh, you'll get this kind of click-through rate, you know, but you can measure your click-through rate through two options. One, you can generate custom links on your Kickstarter, yep, and you can name it this podcast. You can name it this Facebook page group. You can name it this website, this person, this influencer, whatever. You can create custom links after the Kickstarter has been made. And if you want to do it before the Kickstarter is made, you can use a service like, I think Bitly gives you like 10 free links. That data will go away eventually, but there are link tracking options that are free and easy to use that you can generate in order to track what's working where. We did it a little bit where we're just like, let's just make it one like social media link so that when we share on social media, we know how much we generate, you know, as far as actual backers go on the Kickstarter. I just wanted to give that as a resource everyone can use. All right. We are actually going to have to wrap up. Okay. Yep. So first, I want to say it's been great having you guys here. All right. Thank you. And if you guys want, we made this all about like your journey and helping other people. If you guys want another wall to bounce off of, we can do another one of these down the line. You just let me know. But with that, go ahead and do the fullest plug you want to do for Traveler's Guide to Factions, which is live on Kickstarter for, by the time I launch this, like 9 days only.
Josh, you want to take it, or are we hammered up on bandwidth enough where Glenn and I have it? Glenn, take it away.
Sure, let's see if my internet decides to cooperate here. Yeah.
I'll give it a shot, Josh. You usually have the spiel the most practice. If we break up, I'll take over.
I know, I'm working on it. Okay. Live until October 24th. We're at 80% funded right now, $3,000 goal. Literally, we need 10 people to buy a physical copy of the book, and we're funded. So if you want a physical copy of the book, go get on that.
Right. And that's to support the Traveler's Guide to Factions, which is going to be a large book that includes 9 separate, distinct, fully fleshed out factions that you can drag and drop into your world or worlds across nearly any genre and any time period. Because while we're going to write each of them as a snapshot picture of what we envisioned when we created it, we're also going to give advice throughout. Like there's a section about what it would look like through the ages, starting with like a Bronze Age neoclassical, moving up to a Renaissance steampunk, to a modern or dystopian, and all the way into a sci-fi future. And we're going to imagine with you and provide questions to help you flesh out how it would change or what it would look like if you took it into these new environments, to really try to make it as universal and as system agnostic as possible. We are including 5e mechanics that could be used in any 5e compatible system, whether it be the actual game of Dungeons and Dragons or any of the 5e spinoffs from Everyday Heroes to Daggerheart, which Critical Role is coming out with, to the project from Kobold Press.
Tales of the Valiant. Army Men.
Thank you, Tales of the Valiant. I was about to try to go with Project Black Flag. I'm like, no, that's not the name. That was the project name. Tales of the Valiant, Army Men, any of those, you should be able to pull these into it. Now, some of them are going to have subject matter, like one of them deals specifically with the undead. So in the event that the undead don't work in your world, There will also be guidance about how they could be reflavored to work against any other kind of Zerg type rival or enemy that's taking over the world. But the goal is to make this as lore agnostic as possible, ready to go, so that we can help you set it up and bring it to life in your game. It will also include custom art. There's a bunch of stretch goals that can make it even better than it currently stands, because all of our stretch goals are content added stretch goals. So that every new goal we meet will add more stuff to the book and make it longer. And then the last chapter of the book, which we have not started yet, we're waiting until we're done with the initial writing, is going to be how to take our process and apply it to your own ideas, to create your own factions, to give you the secret sauce, to help you bring your own organizations to life, to add this extra depth to your world. And we've got great ideas for that, but we don't want to start it till we finish learning our lessons, which we're still learning as we write against our template. So in the end, this could be anywhere from 150 to 200 pages long, depending on how our stretch goals come out. I mean, it could be a beefy boy. It could get over 200 easy if we hit all of our stretch goals. And it should be a fantastic resource for storytellers who are populating worlds and players who are working on backgrounds. Because as an example, one of our stretch goals creates a background and feat unique to each faction to help you base your character out of it. Because all of these have some forms of shades of gray. They're not all, none of them are all good. None of them are all evil. They all land somewhere in the middle on that scale. And yeah, if that sounds good to you, head on over to Kickstarter and back us. Please, please, please.
And to give you the quick bullet point version, which is usually not my place in this cadre of folks, usually do the longer version, and then Josh or Glenn will cover the bullet point version. In summary, Traveler's Guide to Factions, 9 factions, separate, distinct, that will work in at your game table anytime, any system, any table. That's the key.
I love it. I love all of it. I love the long. I love the short. It's great. I'm backing it. I did go ahead and up my pledge level to the Traveler's Guide Factions beyond the community level, so that someone else can have an opportunity to have that community spot. And because obviously you guys sold me. I just talked to you
for I appreciate that. Thank you.
Because I want you to get that little bit closer to that 3,000. I'm really confident for you guys. I hope very much that you succeed. I hope everyone here listens, checks it out, and at least shares it, even if they're not in the place to back. And if they are in a place to even throw $10 into that community pile to do that or beyond.
I would also add this, something that another education point that we've been talking about in-house and haven't kind of figured out the magic way to do this is, if folks like the add-ons, or let's say this is not the project for you, but you've got a kid brother or a good friend that this would really work for, you can do something like back for $1 and then pick up an add-on. If you've got a family member that likes mugs, because we've got that great cover we talked about that'll be on a mug or on a t-shirt. You want to back the book at $10, do an add-on and buy a mug for your spouse, or buy a t-shirt for your kid brother or something like that. If you want the stickers that we have, because you've got younger kids in your household and you want them to be able to put a sticker on their lunchbox or whatever the case may be. I don't even know. Do kids even have lunchboxes anymore? But whatever the case may be, and
everybody's got a laptop now, and it's really and we're all really into sticking stickers to our laptop though. So that'll
work. Absolutely. And think about this as content creators when you back other Kickstarters. If that's something maybe you don't have the means of, that dollar backing and one of the smaller add-ons, if enough people who want to just support the artists and the content creators that are out there doing good works did just that, that can cover a lot of ground, and it's always appreciated. So there are a lot of different ways to support your fellow artists. Not everything that I back do I back at that level to get that special cover glossy book with the 15,000 different things and the virtual VTT and all the other happy stuff that goes with it. I didn't back a Marvel thing and get Galactus or anything like that. But some things it's like, hey, I can throw them a couple dollars to say, hey, I really like what you're doing. And, hey, while you're at it, throw me a sticker You know, there are things you can do to support fellow content creators, fellow artists, fellow people in the TTRPG community. And I would encourage, as you not just look at ours, it's not entirely self-serving, but as you look at any Kickstarter that's out there, that if you like what they put down, if that intro video interested you and you're like, man, that'd be nice, but I don't have it really this month, consider doing something like that if you can.
Yep. I love it. And we do have to wrap up here, so we're going to say goodbye, but I want to say, like, I got to have you guys on again because you brought up like 500 other things that I want to talk about. Like, how do you manage so many products? How is the book printing going? Who did you use? What are you doing in the next 5 years? So on and so forth. So you guys are a wealth of knowledge. I think that you're great. I love that this is just an excellent case study in going from the micro to something a little macro. And then where do you go from there? I got to have you guys back in the future. But until then, we're going to say goodbye and hope that everybody has a great day, night, year, life, and so on.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good night, all. Thank
you. Later, all. Thanks, Zach.
Yep. Thanks, Zach.